You're listening to a Voices in the Family special. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. On today's show, we're exploring hope and hopelessness and how both could actually be helpful when faced with a life-threatening illness, a degenerative disease, or really any significant trauma. Might hopelessness for a desired outcome actually improve the quality of our lives? Well, on a personal note, I've had some experience with hopelessness. When I had my accident 38 years ago, my doctor told me, in effect, that there's no cure for spinal cord injury and that likely I would never walk again. Well, of course, I went into a deep depression with some suicidal thinking. But after that, I got to a point where I said to myself, okay, how do I live with this? And that was really the beginning of my life when I said, how can I live with this? And I couldn't have gotten there without hopelessness. So, you know, let's not be so quick to say hopelessness is no good and hope is the answer. The reverse, of course, is also true. So that's what we're going to be talking about, hope, hopelessness, and healing. Later on, we're going to talk with two physicians, Dr. John Hanson Flashen's a pulmonologist, and he's also a critical care physician at the University of Pennsylvania.
Hopelessness is a portal to a healthier approach to a chronic disease and to a happier place to be.
Dr. Jerome Groopman is chairman of the Department of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He's also a staff writer for The New Yorker and has multiple books under his name, including The Anatomy of Hope.
You have an awareness that time is not infinite. And that, I think, brings into really tight focus what is meaningful in life and what is secondary.
But first, we're going to be speaking with Diane DeFulvio. Diane's a native Philadelphian who's been living with multiple sclerosis since 1984. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. I want to go back. Before you were diagnosed, before you had any symptoms, what was your life like?
I was very, very active. I, at times, my father would be very upset with me because of everything that I wanted to do and everything that I did. And he said, like, you got to slow down, girl. And I was like, not till 6 feet under will I slow down. And I was just a very active young lady.
What was happening to you that led you to a doctor in the first place?
Well, actually, I had a fall, and I thought I had hit my tailbone because my left leg was numbing on me. And what I would do was bang my foot because I used to go away on ski trips on the weekend. Well, I had carpal tunnel syndrome, and when I went back because my other hand was numbing on me, I was at the doctor's office. And he saw me banging my foot because it went to sleep. And he said to me, I've noticed what you were doing in the waiting room. What's wrong? And I said, oh, I fell on the steps and I hit my tailbone. And my leg numbs on me. So if I bang it, I get the feeling back. And he said to me, I want you to go see a neurologist. I had no clue why. I went on a Monday to see a neurologist in Paoli. And he did a test, a nerve test. And told me to come back on Friday. And Friday, I got the devastating news that I was diagnosed with MS.
So, you got that news. If I can ask, how old were you?
I was 27.
So you were a kid.
The prime of my life.
Yeah, kid. You thought you were a grown-up like I did when I had my accident. But you were a kid. So, when you got the news, what happened to you?
I cried.
That was your first reaction?
I cried. I didn't know what MS was. I didn't know how to spell it. And I had taken time off from work to go to the doctor to get the results. I landed up at my sister's house, hysterical crying.
You were alone?
When I got the diagnosis, yes, I was alone.
Oh. Did you think you were going to die?
That was the first thing. I'm going to die. You know, what is this? You didn't hear about MS very frequently as you do these days. And my family didn't know anything about it. So when I went back to work on Monday and I told my boss, he said, well, we're going to get through this together.
Wow.
And do research on it and find out exactly why, how, what the prognosis was.
You're lucky to have a boss like that, especially back then when we didn't deal very much with any kind of disability. What kind of support system did you have?
I have a close Italian family, and it was a learning experience for all of us, but they were very supportive of me. My coworkers, my boss. It took me some time in order to get involved with the MS Society, Delaware Valley Chapter. But once I did, I found support through them.
Tell me about the early days, first year, 2 years. What were they like living with that label?
Well, I really didn't have any symptoms. When I look back, I was having double vision in one eye. And before I was diagnosed, I just thought it was an eye problem. I didn't relate it to anything, let alone MS. The numbing of my leg. But doing the research, these were all symptoms that deal with MS. And I went through depression, which is one of the early stages after you're diagnosed. And I was like, why me?
Did you feel hopeless?
I did, because I didn't really understand the disease. I didn't know what it was going to do with to me. And like I said, I thought I was going to eventually die.
When you say hopeless, it sounds like despair.
You do. The denial period, it's like, why me? You know, you just want to give up. But without the support that I had, I think a lot of people do give up. And that's one of the reasons why I like talking to newly diagnosed patients. And our conversations are not that of, oh, poor me, why me? We don't even bring up any of that. It's always laughter, like, what could we do? You know, oh, well, let's do this or let's do that. And it's very positive. If anything negative, I kind of push you out.
Well, you know, you almost don't need words. You just have to look at you, and you've got this cherubic smiling face. Tell me how you are now.
Oh, I'm great now. I'm trying to learn how to walk again, which is very difficult being diagnosed with MS. I'm trying everything, horseback riding. I have a personal trainer. But mostly, I'm very active. I work full-time for a major law firm that I celebrate 39 years, November 1st.
Wow.
And I'm involved in all the MS events. I have a bike team. I have a walk team. And it's just, I keep going. I drive. In fact, today I drove one of my volunteer friends all through South Philadelphia, my old neighborhood. And she's like, do you know where you're going? Yeah, I do. Just sit back and enjoy.
I didn't think anybody knew where they were going in South Philly.
Once you've lived there most of your life.
Yeah, of course.
But I don't give up.
Diane, do you remember by any chance that period of transition from hopelessness to hope, feeling more positive?
I don't think I was ever hopeless. It was more of not knowing. When I'm like that, like today, I will Google. If I don't understand something, I will Google it. I always like to have a better understanding of what's going on. And that's why I like talking to newly diagnosed patients that have been diagnosed with MS, because they have no idea what the disease is. A lot of people say, oh, my friend died of MS. You do not die of MS. You die of complications caused by the MS. And it really gets me upset when people say that, or like people like, you don't look like you have MS. Like, no. And my motto was, I have MS, but MS does not have me.
Right, right.
It's not going to take over.
Diane, I remember many years ago, a man called me for a advice or consultation. I don't remember which. But his opening words were, I'm an MS patient. And I said, when's the last time you were in a hospital? I said, long, long time. I said, when's the last time you saw a doctor? So what makes you a patient? You know, you're a man. living with the disease. But I hear that a lot.
You can't know? Make it take control over you.
How's the future look to you?
Great. I hope to work for another 20, 30 years if I can. I'll never give up having my teams to do the MS events. I think the MS Society would be very upset with me if I said, I'm giving up. I'm not doing it anymore because I'm one of their top fundraisers and their number one volunteer.
That's great.
I'm just happy camper.
Tell me how your disease is progressing, say, over the last 10 years, even 5
well,
years.
Well, the good news is when I saw my neurologist in January of 2017, she went through all my MRIs. And she told me that since 2005 to present, which was January 2017, my MRIs really did not change. And having gone through what I went through, she said, I'm taking you off all your drugs.
Really?
So really? Presently, I do not get my weekly muscular injections. I do, though, every so often, if I have a major event coming up, I get what I call my high-test gasoline, which is an IV steroid infusion for 3 to 4 days. And it just gives me a pick-me-up. But I don't refer to it as medication. It's my high-test gasoline.
Hmm. What a wonderful attitude you have. And it's great that, you know, you haven't seen any progress. You better put your law firm on alert because you could be there 20 or 30 years. And let's hope there's a 5% raise every year.
You think?
Well, I get a piece of that if you get it because I recommend it. It's wonderful. Diane, you're going to stay with us after this short break.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. That was Diane DeFulvio. She's with a large law firm here in Philadelphia, and she's been living and obviously thriving with MS, or despite MS, since 1984. We're going to take that one-minute break. Coming up next, we'll hear from Diane, and we'll be joined by Dr. John Hansen Flash, and he's a pulmonologist from the University of Pennsylvania. That's next on this Voices in the Family special. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We'll be right back. Welcome back to this Voices in the Family special. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Today, we're exploring hope, hopelessness, and healing. In addition to Diane DeFulvio, who's been living with MS for 33 years now, we're also joined by Dr. John Hansen Flashen. He's a pulmonary and critical care physician at the University of Pennsylvania. He frequently talks about counseling people with poor or terminal prognoses. Welcome to both of you. John, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan.
Tell us about the kind of patients you work with.
As a pulmonary physician, I see patients with diagnostic dilemmas and also people with advanced lung disease, diseases that take away their breath and cause them to be short of breath on limited exertion.
And what's the prognosis generally?
There are many different diseases that cause shortness of breath. Some of the diseases I deal with can be fatal within months to a year or two, but many others are live with diseases. They hold somebody down, limit their activities and the circumference of their lives, but don't for sure over a limited period of time take their lives away.
That language, I never heard it before. The circumference of their lives. What do you mean?
Well, when doctors think about dyspnea, they talk about an uncomfortable sense of breathing. But in real life, people with a chronic lung disease or a neuromuscular disease that makes their breathing weak, in real life, they avoid activities that cause uncomfortable breathing by having less activity. That less activity gives them a smaller world. They may live in their bedroom or their home or just their immediate neighborhood.
When you're meeting with someone, John, who you must inform that they're terminally ill or have a grim prognosis, do you plan what you're going to say ahead of time? And what's your agenda?
I do plan the outlines of my conversation, but very important to fill in the details as I hear from a patient. If I'm laying out new information that conveys a poor prognosis, I start with a simple one or two sentence statement of the diagnosis, and then I wait and listen to be guided by how the person responds as to how I'll react and speak next.
For example?
Many people are floored, for example, by a new diagnosis of advanced lung cancer or severe chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. It sets them back, and I know that if I talk too soon on my agenda, they won't hear anything I say. So I ask for their questions to be guided about where to go next.
And for people who aren't surprised or floored by the diagnosis, what's your agenda there?
Yeah, well, I still wait for them to respond and react to that. Very often people do ask for a prognosis, and I have a way of unfolding a prognosis that I think is helpful to many people.
How so?
Some doctors say you have 6 months to live, or that's what the patient takes away from the conversation. And we don't know that. We never can say that. So I like to bracket a prognosis, starting with often the negative side and going to the positive side. Some people with your condition, unlucky, die within weeks or a couple months. Others are functional and independent in their lives 2 or 3 years from now, many people in between. To me, that bracketing is an honest and fair statement of what I know about prognosis, but leaving with a more positive side allows a person who has hope and is reaching forward to talk about how we might get there to the positive end of the spectrum.
What else do you do to make yourself an ally?
I ask straight out, what are your hopes for the future? And a second question is, what are your fears for the future? People are entitled to their hopes. But somewhere along the line, if not a first visit, then a subsequent one, I tried to explore with them a hope or a group of hopes that are achievable, that the patient and I can work together toward achieving.
For example?
A person with a new diagnosis of pulmonary fibrosis, a terrible, progressive, suffocating disease, already short of breath and limited in their life, might start out saying, I want to be cured of my disease. I want to be free of it, go back to my life. We don't know how to make that happen nowadays, but research is undergoing all the way, all the time, and how do I know that won't happen? There are another set of goals that I can be more helpful with, that a person expand their circumference, be more active, more engaged, and that they not suffer shortness of breath as their disease progresses. So I talk about those as goals, and sometimes, very often, people will understand hope for a miracle is about prayer. I'll share those prayers with them, but hope for a bigger world and less suffering is something that patient and I can work on together.
Yeah, and that also contributes to well-being. You alluded to something about connection with people. I know from experience, you can be less active and more connected, and one leads more towards hope, happiness, well-being. Active certainly leads to better health, but you can't separate it. I saw, Diane, you're sitting over there nodding with this smirk on your face. What were you reacting to?
I like the fact that you say hope. My philosophy, don't ever give up hope. It may happen today, it may happen tomorrow. It may not happen today or tomorrow, but just go through each day. My saying it as if it was your last, because we don't have a say. So why be miserable living each day and make it a happy time for both yourself and those around you.
I once had a patient who had pretty advanced cancer, and she had hope, and prognosis was pretty grim, and she knew it, but she had hope, and she was going through all these, to me, bizarre treatments, coffee enemas and whatnot. And she was quite stressed and unhappy, as one might think. And then one day, she saw her last MRI and knew that this wasn't going to get cured. And she came into my office looking better than I'd seen her look in a long, long time. She gave up the battle that was exhausting her. And deep down inside, she knew it was a failure and stopped fighting. And, sometimes you stop fighting, it takes away a battle in your life, and then you can have a better quality of life. I watched her sit with her daughter in my office, just holding each other. I don't know if they would have done that if she was still fighting. So, there is that place. I mean, there's another side of it, too. I just heard a story today from a dear friend of mine whose friend had a particularly virulent kind of cancer. And the doctor said he had 6 months to 2 years. And his reaction to that was, well, then I'm going to do whatever the hell I want. And he died of a drug overdose. Now, that might have been what he wanted, or it might have been his reaction to having no hope. So how do you judge what to say to whom?
By all means, hope can be a negative driver. Take people in a wrong direction that brings them frustration and ultimately to a sense of hopelessness. And hopelessness is an opportunity to redirect toward another set of desires that are potentially in reach. So I have so often seen what you talked about, Dan, where hopelessness is a portal to a healthier approach to a chronic disease and to a happier place to be.
Diane, we heard John's, in my estimation, beautiful description of how he tells a patient, more important, how he listens. When you learned you had MS, do you remember what the doctor said?
Oh, I remember as if it was yesterday.
Sure.
He said to me, he didn't really explain it all. He just says, the test came back positive that you have MS.
Done. That was it?
Yeah.
Do you know, Diane, John, I've spoken to a lot of people who've lived through some terrible things in their lives from childhood on. And everyone who got through it and not just survived but thrived said the same thing. There was always somebody there when I needed it. And very often, John, with your patients, it's you. The message is, I'm available, I'm here, I care. That's not the message Diane got.
Well, it's hard for family members to understand that someone close to them has a disease. And again, nobody knew what it was because you didn't hear about it as much as you do now.
John and Diane, people rail against chronic illness or a terminal diagnosis, anything that might lead towards death. And sure, they do it because they don't know what happens on the other side. But they also do it because we love life. We love having a life. And if we could wake up to that, whether it's 6 months or 6 days, we still have a life that we love. And, spend more time loving the life that you have. So I want to know, I guess, from you, John, I wonder about the wisdom you've acquired after all these years being with people who are living and dying. What have you learned about yourself? Has it changed you?
Oh, I think very completely and in many ways. When I went off to medical school, my mother said, medical school and medicine will change you forever. Well, that's still changing me. And I think for a while now, I'm an older physician. My best teachers are my patients. And I learn by listening to them and by observing them. Much of the wisdom I've acquired in recent years comes out of all of my patients, but some special patients in particular who are very articulate about their experience and could turn back around and guide and teach me.
Yeah, and many of my doctors have said that to me. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to say goodbye to both of you, but my guests have been Dr. John Hansen Fleshen. He's a pulmonary and critical care physician at the University of Pennsylvania. We also heard from Diane DeFulvio, a Philadelphia native who's been living with multiple sclerosis since 1984. We'll be back after a short break. Coming up next, I'll be speaking with Dr. Jerome Groopman, who's the chair of the Department of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. He's published several books, including The Anatomy of Hope. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to this Voices in the Family special right here on WHYY-FM. We'll be right back after this break. And welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about hope, hopelessness, and healing. And now we're joined by Dr. Jerome Groopman. He holds the Dana and Raphael Recanti Chair of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. His work focuses on blood disease, cancer, and AIDS. He's a frequent contributor to The New Yorker and New York Times, and has written several books, including The Measure of Our Days, Second Opinions, and The Anatomy of Hope. Thank you for joining me.
Hi.
Jerry, when you were doing your residency, you began working for a physician who specialized in treating people with cancer. It was there that you began thinking about false hope and true hope. What happened that got you thinking about that?
Well, this was a clinician who I very much admired. He seemed very attentive and caring with his patients. But he was seeing a woman who had metastatic colon cancer. It had spread from her colon to her liver. And he didn't tell her the truth about what was wrong. He thought in some way that he was protecting her from the fear of death and the potential risk of pain and debility. But it turned out that by withholding the truth and giving her false hope instead of being explicit, he did her a grave disservice because she didn't, first of all, have the opportunity to use the time available to set her life in order, so to speak, reconcile with family and friends, accomplish things she might want to do. And as things deteriorated and it became clear what the truth was, there was a great deal of bitterness, disappointment, and a sense of betrayal. And that, to me, was a very jarring lesson about distinguishing between true hope and false hope.
Yeah, I wonder if that was the norm back then.
I think it very much was, and until recently, to some degree in the United States, but actually more in Europe, a colleague of mine who's a physician and geneticist's mother actually had a very similar situation where she had bowel cancer that had spread to her liver, and they did not tell her the diagnosis. They kept telling her that she had hepatitis.
How unfair is that? You know, there's research, I'm sure you know as well as I do, that Now, when someone knows they are dying, that's the most precious time of life. You know, they give up all the stuff, and mostly they find peace, and they recognize that the most important thing is love and being with people they love. So that's what these doctors deprive their patients.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that in terms of presenting true hope, a doctor can say, of course, we had hoped for a cure or we had hoped for a prolonged remission, but that's not happening. So what else can we hope for now? And precisely what you said, to have time, precious time, with family, to be able to embrace love in a way that is meaningful, and to hopefully leave with memories to those who are still living that are meaningful and positive. And all of that can be a gift. So I think that to cheat someone out of that through false hope is really a disservice to the person, to the family, and a betrayal, actually, of what we as physicians should be, which is not only clinicians or treaters, but healers.
So what you're talking about, when you talk about false hope, and you know, the theme of the show is hope, hopelessness, and healing, in a way, that false hope actually interferes with healing, with a deeper sense of healing.
Absolutely. That, you know, it's very interesting because, I come from a Jewish tradition, and when you, in synagogue, if you pray for a sick person, they say, refuah to nefesh, healing of the soul, refuah to guf, healing of the body. And one day I was thinking about this, and I thought, you know, why is it that the first request is to heal the soul and the second is the body? Because particularly with healing, you usually think in a pragmatic way that you want physical healing. And then I realized that for all of us, there will come a time when physical healing is not possible, when there won't be a cure, because we're all mortal. But even until the very last breath, there is an opportunity to heal the soul. And that is something that should be the focus and often becomes the primary focus, the first priority in a situation like the one you're talking about.
Yeah, and part of healing the soul, I mean, a healed soul experiences fearless love, open-hearted love, generous love, and does it more often to more people and finds themselves at peace and just experiencing more love more readily. I gave a lecture once, Jerry, and it was entitled, "As Long as You Have Your Health, You Have Everything, and Other Lies My Mother Told Me."
Well, you know, I'm a great believer in mother's wisdom. My own mother, after 14 years of breast cancer, with long periods, thankfully, of remission where she was able to function and visit grandchildren and participate in community activities and so on, she would also say that health is basically everything. It's the starting point. Mm. And then when she knew that she was dying, remarkably, she said, you know, I've reached that point. I've reached the end. And about 2 hours later, she passed away. And it's very unusual because I've clearly, as an oncologist, a cancer specialist, have seen a lot of people die. And it's not always, you know, like in the movies where you just close your eyes and take a breath and that's it. But for some people it is. And I had a sense, even though I don't know the biology of this, that by really relinquishing whatever life force was remaining, it allowed her to pass without without pain or struggle.
What a blessing. You know, John Kabat-Zinn, the well-known man who brought meditation to this country, he got his doctorate from MIT, believe it or not, and he tells his story about how the cover page of his dissertation said, if a man dies before he dies, then when he dies, he doesn't really die. And, you know, on one level that makes no sense, but I've got personal experience of coming so close to death, I felt like I could inhale death. And I've been there two or three times, one relatively recently, and all of it, to me, is about rehearsing death. So it doesn't, it's not new, and, you know, you rehearse enough, you're comfortable. And I'm more comfortable with that than I ever was. And because of that, I live as though I'm dying, like the people you described and I just described.
Well, I think you know, we none of us, at least I don't, you know, we don't live on the edge all the time. It's not a way to some degree, but to know and recognize our mortality, as you're doing, is a very important dimension of how to live. That you have an awareness that time is not infinite. You have an awareness of the gifts that you're currently enjoying in terms of health and function, and the people around you, the relationships. And that, I think, brings into really tight focus what is meaningful in life and what is secondary.
Exactly. How lucky am I? So I want to ask you the same question I asked Dr. John Hanson Flash in a previous segment. So when you're meeting with someone who you must inform is terminally ill, do you plan what you're going to say? Do you think about it in advance, or is it spontaneous? Do you go in with an agenda?
What I think about is the person. I think about what I know about him or her, what we've talked about in the past. Again, as a cancer specialist, given the uncertainties that exist in all of medicine, but particularly in treatment, there's a best case scenario and a worst case scenario. And with all of my patients, I try to address that relatively early on. And we know what the worst case scenario is from the clinical point of view, is that the treatment doesn't work. And we know the best case, which is that there's a dramatic improvement. And then there's often a result that's between those two extremes. So, in contradistinction to the first patient we talked about who was given false hope, I think it's very important from the outset to just lay out what the possible outcomes are. And then I don't believe in a preformed script. I really bristle at the idea that everyone is treated generically, that this is what you say to someone who's an 80-year-old grandmother and the same thing you would say to a 28-year-old athlete, you know, or a 50-year-old, or what, you know, each person's individual, and each person's words and language and how to engage in a discussion that is this difficult but important needs to be individualized. And I try to do that based on my knowledge of the person.
What's that like for you, Jerry?
I still sometimes, and this is a problem I think doctors have, all doctors, but is sometimes you think, you know, did I fail? Did I do everything correctly? Did I respond to each complication as effectively as I could have? You know, did we embark on the best protocol that or cocktail of treatments that might have been used for this particular disease? So there's a lot of self-reflection from the clinical point of view. And then I also try to see how I succeeded or fell short in addressing the emotional and spiritual needs of the person, which, again, are varied from individual to individual. So, you know, I'm fortunate that I have a wonderful marriage, great kids, now grandkids, colleagues, and so on. And I also swim a lot, which is a great release. So the emotional burden, which is real, is lessened to some degree through those aspects of my life. But it's still very, very difficult. And even though we all know as doctors we're not perfect and this is life, I'm still very tough on myself.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I think it's true of a lot of oncologists that I know who you try to do your best and you want to make sure you're always doing your best and you know you are not perfect. That kind of being tough on yourself, I think, even though it's difficult, it can sometimes highlight for you where you weren't as effective as you could have been, or mm-hmm. you didn't communicate as well with the person as you should have. And then you absorb that self-reflection and hopefully do better the next time.
I want to address the issue of hope and hopelessness in everyday life. I've got patients, many over the years, who live with the hope that their spouse will change, their parents will change, their history will change. You know, I have patients who live with hope that they'll find exactly the right spouse, their quote, soulmate. And these people turn out to be pretty unhappy. That kind of hope can really be destructive. And here's a case where hopelessness would be helpful.
You know, perfection doesn't exist in this way. And so I think if you understand your own limitations and you understand how you can grow in relationships or in work or in situations that initially may seem disappointing or burdensome, hope really involves a very clear-eyed view that there can be a path to something better. And that, when I've written about it, is how it's distinguished from optimism. An optimist says, oh, things are going to get better. That's my mindset. Well, things don't always get better. And the difference between hope and optimism is that true hope is clear-eyed. And then it becomes sort of an existential issue where you're the one who needs to examine yourself and your relationships and your environment and act in a way to try to make it better, to try to find that path.
Yeah, to me, it starts, Jerry, with this question. How do I live the life I have with the person I am, with the history I've had, with the mind I have? How do I live this life without trying to fight with it? You know, and that's the fundamental question we must start with. Not that there's no hope that something will change in the future, but, man, you know, one of my meditation teachers, defined stress as trying to change the moment you're in. Not going to happen.
To my mind, there's a way of looking at the situation you're in at the moment and appreciating the positive. But I also feel, and it just may be a different sort of worldview or upbringing and so on, is that for me, a lot of life is about an opportunity for self-improvement. And by improving your own self, understanding you'll never be perfect, but trying to relinquish those things that are negative or limiting or neurotic or whatever, strengthening your own attributes, particularly in relationships. I would say that my wife, we've been married 38 years, and she has made me such a better person in so many ways because of the kinds of changes and compromises and insights that came about during those decades. So to my mind, you know, the great thing about hope is that, yes, you're in the moment, but you also can imagine the future.
I'm really curious about something here. I read where you've studied the physiology of hope. Tell me what you learned. Can we find it in the brain? Can we change it?
Yeah, I think there, like every other powerful emotion, even though we experience ourselves, as Descartes said, you know, with a mind and body dissociation, we're certainly an integrated being. So our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions have a chemical substrate, a chemical basis, and they also ramify. And, you know, the closest approximation of hope, of true hope, which is an uplifting, positive kind of feeling that there is something that can be better and we can help get there, I think has two sort of physical dimensions. One is it allows us to cope with what is often very limiting in a clinical setting, and that is pain. And just like a placebo, but hope is not a placebo, and placebos are actually very positive in a lot of ways. They have release of endorphins, as you know, in the brain. They have multiple effects on pain pathways and strength pathways and so on. So I think that there's that dimension. I also think there's an effect on our cognition, that by being clear-eyed, by being realistic and yet feeling hope, it allows us to organize our mind in a more effective way and to see which path might be best for us to follow. And that is very important to my mind, you know, and if it's within the context of being a doctor, from both a sort of a clinical physical point of view, but also an emotional spiritual point of view. What choices are you making? How do you bring your own values and preferences to bear within the context of what is often a very difficult situation, which is treatment for cancer?
Jerry, I want to ask you one final question. Around the publication of The Anatomy of Hope, you said the work was a mirror image of your limits and shortcomings. You certainly gained a great deal of wisdom in your career. So tell me, your limits and shortcomings, have they grown or have they shrunk?
I would say that my shortcomings and limitations have shrunken. They're still there, for sure. But I have grown a lot, and I attribute that, as I said, in part to what I've gained from relationships of love, from having children, and from my patients, who often have taught me important lessons about what's meaningful and what's not, and how to find inner resilience.
Jerry, I want to thank you so much for giving us this time out of your busy schedule. And it was great speaking with you again.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Jerome Grootman is chair of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He's also chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital Medical Center in Boston. He's written 5 books, including The Anatomy of Hope. You've been listening to a Voices in the Family special. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Our executive producer is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Ali L'Esperance is the producer of Voices in the Family. Al Banks and Bob Alls have been our engineers. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.